I'm John Perry, and this is Selected Prose. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Selected Prose. I sat down with B.R. Yeager to discuss his latest book, Negative Space. Negative Space was published by Apocalypse Party. It is a wild, wild ride, very apt for the present moment we are living in. It's a horror novel about youth and grief and the internet and memes and drugs and the occult and madness. B.R.'s last book was titled Amygdalatropolis. He's also the creator of Pearl Death, which is a novelette that tells the history of a dead civilization, but it is told through a deck of playing cards. I think in terms of the forms that storytelling can take, this is one of the more interesting I've heard of. We discussed that. We also discussed literature in the era of Netflix, what its purpose is, whether fiction can ever get more entertaining than a Netflix series or doom-scrolling Twitter. The answer, of course, is that it can. BR explains to us why that is. Negative Space shows us how. I have linked to his work in the episode description. Highly recommend checking him out. I hope you're doing well. I am posting this as election results stream in. Everyone's panicking. It's pandemonium. It is a free-for-all. We are all losing our minds. We are living in a B.R. Yeager novel. Turn off the TV. Forget the news. You did your part. Log off of Twitter. Log off of Facebook and all the rest. Now and forever. Amen. Now for B.R. Yeager. Welcome. Thanks for taking the time to come talk to me. The first person I interviewed for the podcast was David Leo Rice, and we were talking about the new weird and the horror genre in general, and he could not have recommended you highly enough. So it's kind of cool how it all comes full circle. But how have things been for you in life with Negative Space?
I mean, things have been... You know, it's been a roller coaster, like it has been for everyone. I'm in a lucky position right now of just being able to like work from home, so I'm just thankful for that. Things have been wild with Negative Space. We were doing some promotions for October, and it's been just getting around a lot, getting circulated quite a bit, so it seems to be going pretty well.
I want to ask right off the bat where this cover art comes from.
Oh, so that was designed by a designer, Matthew Revert. He's an author, and he's he does a lot of jacket designs. Phenomenal artist. I think that he does some of my favorite jacket designs today, and was just really happy to have him do one for this. He's done those for like the majority of Apocalypse Party's jackets before, so I'm not sure where the source material came from. Mm-hmm. But that was what he had sent after hearing the description about it, and was just very happy with that.
Yeah, it's quite gorgeous. I'm carrying it around as I read it, and people are like, what the hell is that?
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you.
And I explain it to them, but I think it'd be better to hear from you, maybe kind of like what is Negative Space?
Cool. So it's essentially a horror story that's kind of in the genre of what I call the kids on bike genre. So like thinking of It or... Something Wicked This Way Comes, those kinds of horror stories. But I wanted to do a like very modern and more realistic, at least to what being in high school and being a teen was for myself and my friends. But it's essentially about four kids who are in this dying mill town in New Hampshire. There's this bizarre suicide epidemic that's going on. Most of it has been young people. And to kind of try to escape from this, they start using this hallucinogen that is it starts impacting objective reality the more that they take it. And that's kind of the foundational there. It's not from there, it's mostly about the just sort of the kids' relationships with each other and how they're kind of coping with the kind of destruction of their town.
So this drug interests me a lot, actually. So it's called Whirl, right?
Yeah.
You buy it at a gas station.
That's where they purchase it, yes.
Yeah. So I'd say maybe I wouldn't want to call them nostalgic drugs, but like salvia was big for a while. You don't really have to get into your experience with those, but it works in that kind of way where it makes me think.
No, it was very much inspired by salvia and what we called gas station weed for like a little while. It was it was often called spice or K3, I forget, or K2. Utterly horrifying. But it was some herbs, definitely not marijuana, coated with certain substances that would get you high if you incinerated them. And those were legal and you could buy them at gas stations. I think some kids got fucking heart attacks doing that before. But then also it was so that the way that was packaged, the way that it sold was inspired by that. The actual experience was much more inspired by salvia, which is this 8 minute long, like 5 to 8 minute long, really intense trip. If you smoke it, supposedly if you chew it, that's actually the way that you're supposed to do it in shamanic practices and things like that. But that's also, it is in Massachusetts, I think, still illegal, but those were the two inspirations behind it.
And so one of the things that really interests me about Negative Space is, you know, I'm currently enrolled in a writing program it's good, but everybody wants to write about the internet. Like, I mean, it's just like this massive unavoidable force in our lives, obviously, but in literature, it's kind of like hard to write about in fiction. I think people sometimes feel, I don't know, maybe overwhelmed. Maybe if you could just talk about how you do that and how you did it so well.
Cool. Thank you so much. I really appreciate hearing that. I forget who had said it. I think I had just seen it on Twitter several years ago, but I think that they put it really, really well here. Is if you're writing about today, then not including it's just a little bit fallacious not to include an online interface or component. That at least that's what that person was saying, what they felt like. I think that that's, there's a very like natural aspect to it of that, you know, the internet and screens, et cetera, are so tied into most of our lives. So not to include that just seemed like I was like missing something if I was to exclude that. But it's also because the internet has been like a big part of my life, like, you know, coming of age in the late 90s, like early aughts, and being on message boards and, you know, sculpting part of your identity through that. So it just seemed like a very essential piece of the puzzle. And like, that's how it's felt like. Amoebalotropolis is like more or less like about the internet, and like it takes place like predominantly in like message boards and like image boards, and that was really born out of just diving into certain online subcultures. And with this, it's like it's much more of just a component of the story, but I think that's like still, it was like really important to include that. And include that aspect of how people sculpt their identities. And, you know, it's a space that allows you to do certain things that you're unable to do in, you know, physical space. And that's just like really compelling to me. I'm always encouraging people to steal things from the internet, like steal techniques of engagement from social media to include in your fiction, even on like a structural way. Yeah, it's just interesting to me.
Politically and stuff, a lot of the, you know, like the 4chan and things like that have found their way in the news, like in the political sphere, but you don't often hear about it. You don't hear about it in an artistic context. It does seem to be this mass sort of like untapped underground.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's, and part of it is that I just like don't have the like the time or patience or energy or the attention. Above anything, I don't really have the attention span to like have keep up with like so much stuff and the barrage. It's just, yeah. You know, like my own kind of like mental faculties are just kind of, you know, they're not what they used to be. But like at the same time, I do think of like the internet as like, or like part pieces of the internet as like one of the, my biggest influences, or like one of the things that where I see some of the most kind of exciting or strange either images or writing. My friend who's a filmmaker who we've worked on a few things together, we were just talking about like different things, like we're working on like a like project, you know, we've been like sending each other, like we're conceptualizing these characters, and like he just sent me like pictures of like tattoos that he's found like around like the internet just from doing like certain searches. And like I'm not sure if you've seen, there's like an image that was going around like a few years ago of this like old rusty bathtub that's just filled with human brains, like from like a morgue or something. As there are these images and like pieces of text that are just like disembodied from a grander narrative, and like it makes it so much more powerful that way, because like you're like creating your own context for it. The context of it is like highly individualized, dependent on like what else you've seen that day. It's just like fascinating. There's just kind of this like well of atmosphere that's like unique to the internet that like I love the idea of like tapping for arts that are outside of the internet, like in literature or film.
Yeah. Do you ever feel confined by like the, like when you're writing a novel, do you feel confined by that medium?
I mean, I haven't, like not really. Just because, you know, I've only written like two novels and then like a very short novelette, and that isn't very many. And like that's, you know, I'm only like confined by my own ability, not by the form at all, because there's so much you can do with it. And like it's you know, I think it would like take a lot of hubris for me to say that. It's like, oh no, there's just the novel is so limited. There's like so much stuff that like that I'm like seeing, especially from like a lot of contemporary writers that just like are people finding like all these different approaches to what a novel is, like what a book is, like the physical object aspect of it, as well as the text. It's constantly humbling. It's like, it's really cool. But yeah, I love the novel as a form. It's really cool.
Yeah. So something that I really enjoyed about Negative Space was the fractured narrative, how we follow Lou, Amir, Jill, and then with reference to Tyler. But is that the first time you have fractured a narrative like that?
No, I'm pretty convinced that that's the only way that I can write. Just because of like my, I get bored very easily, and you know, like my attention span has always been like pretty shot. And for me to do something like long term and long form, I have to be like jumping around a lot. Amygdala Tropolis, it's very much also like broken up into kind of standard prose, message boards, and then more of a abstract or lyrical voice that goes in through that. And so, yeah, I really enjoy both the challenge and the opportunities from having having a fractured narrative, having like shifting voices, going back a little bit to, you know, stealing techniques from social media or like stealing craft from social media. Like that was kind of an intentional thing with the shifting narrative in Negative Space of, you know, trying to make it almost like a little bit more like doing the scroll, like, you know, like the social media scroll of that you have, you know, these three people essentially talking about like sort of what their experiences were throughout this day. And like, you're getting these different perspectives, but also they're sometimes branching out and not having anything to do with each other. I think that that's one of the reasons why social media is so addictive and so compelling. I mean, like the engineers have come out and said this. So it's like, why not steal that, hijack that, to like make your book a little bit more propulsive? Like one of like my goals with that is to make it like a fast thing to read. And like one of the ways of doing that is you're able to see sort of like when a passage is going to end, so it's like easier to like pick up and put down. You don't necessarily have to like be like, okay, do I have like time for 30 or 40 pages of this? You can kind of just, you know, come in and out of it if you want to. And hopefully that makes it, you know, it burn quicker as you're going through it.
It absolutely, you succeeded in that effect. I live in New York, and people have told me before that they've been so immersed in a book that they missed their train station. This has never happened to me except for with Negative Space.
Oh, and that's awesome.
I missed my stop.
Oh, that's awesome.
I wasn't late, but I did miss my stop. I mean, it's very, very, it does have that effect. Like, it is addicting. Did you consciously, when the engineers came out and explained how everything is designed to have an addictive quality, did you take any of those lessons and truly apply them to the text?
Oh yeah, I don't think that they like explained what any of those like specific methodologies were, but it was more about just kind of taking the principle idea, and like that saying that makes it sound like it was like much more intended than it was, because again, I just naturally write that way in a fractured way, yeah. Like jumping from narrative element to narrative element. But I guess when I like heard about that, it made me think of it in a more intentional way of, it just made me like consider the text in a different way, like, you know, having a variety of short and long passages to break it up. Yeah, it was more kind of just like subconsciously like implementing the principle after having like, okay, that's a cool thing to kind of try to hijack.
Especially when it comes, I mean, I get so not irritated, because I'm like, I don't want to get into the whole argument about whether people should read more or whatnot. But when everyone's just like, it's impossible for me to sit through a book. I'm like, come on, it can't be impossible. Maybe we can start making it easier for them. I don't know.
Well, like part of it is that like I empathize with that. Like, you know, like some, like I go through periods where I like feel like I can't fucking read a book. And like I've been kind of like going, you know, I still like read a lot, but I'm like reading less than I would like to during this time, especially like since there's so much time like spent at home. But I'm actually just reading The Shining for the first time.
Oh, wow.
It's a really great book. Go figure. But that's kind of been curing it for me. Like, I just started it on Sunday. I'm already like 160 pages in, and it's just such a gripping, it's an intimidatingly gripping piece of work if you're a writer, because it's just like, how do you fucking think of like this thing? It's just really like tastefully done in a way that like Stephen King isn't necessarily like known for. Getting back to like what you were saying though, I empathize with like feeling like it's like getting through a book is or like we've all read like books where you really love it, but then it's like it breaks down and there's just like a period of time where it's like just a slog to get through. So I'm like, you know, I'm trying not to do that essentially. You make like, it's a really good point though, too. Like another thing that like I've been on this big kick about is that like you're not compete if you're writing books, you're not competing against other writers. You're competing against Netflix and like streaming yes. or whatever yeah. it is. You're competing against the internet. So too, you're competing against social media. So steal that shit. Like mm-hmm. steal like that. Like make yourself like easier to comprehend if you want to. There's also wonderful, wonderful writers who like make like really dense, impenetrable stuff that I admire the hell out of, and like whose work like does like insane stuff to me. But you know, there's a million ways of going about it. It's all about like what your mission is.
I felt with your book, immensely readable, but it also, it's not like a thriller. I mean, it definitely straddles the line between like literary and horror. Is The Shining an example of like literary king, or is he?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I would definitely say so. Like I have no idea like where, like that's the divisions between like genre and literary. That's like another thing where like, I don't really have like a stake in that hunt. Like, I like thinking of like the stuff that I'm doing as like horror stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that, like that's, it's just like a genre that like has always like moved me. And you know, it's just been always like very, very compelling to me. Yeah, like I like if we're talking about like on like the sentence level, like there's a lot of great lines in The Shining thus far. I've been really enjoying it a lot too.
What's your connection to horror? I mean, so I know you're from the New England area.
Yeah.
Are you from New Hampshire originally or Massachusetts?
Western Massachusetts.
Western Mass. Okay.
Yeah. So
how much of your interest in horror stems from your upbringing in New England?
Oh, I imagine that plays a big part. I don't think I knew it at the time. I mean, I found horror very compelling from a very, very early age. You know, Halloween was always big for me. I think I was talking with David maybe about how it's like it not being a thing that you really necessarily like think about in the area, but like I grew up in like the town in like Emily Dickinson's hometown, which is mm-hmm. like you don't really think about that like while you're like here, but it's like, oh shit, yeah, Emily Dickinson, shit. But it's impossible not to talk about like what feels like an inherent eeriness and strangeness to New England. I haven't lived outside of New England, so I can't really talk about other places, but there does seem to be a reason why New England resonates with the horror genre mm-hmm. so much. I think with New Hampshire, what attracted me like personally with that is just, it feels very verdant and primordial in lots of parts of New Hampshire, or at least like parts where I've worked in parts of New Hampshire. I like dated someone in New Hampshire for a long time, and like there's like the expanses of mountains and, you know, just with just like little pockets of like buildings or, you know, roadways, there always feels like there's this like dark energy, this like really heavy vibe that's there that I like love and kind of fear at the same time.
Yeah, it seems in New England more than in other places, and maybe that's just because I've just read Negative Space and I talk to David Rice all the time, but it does seem there's like this, there's far more of a focus on like towns and town, like you don't, I mean, of course in a city you don't get that, but it, you really feel that in New England horror, setting is extremely important. These towns do seem to be like imbued with this sense of like, I don't know, like eeriness and decay.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Just kind of talking about like where, what you were saying earlier about where the decay comes from. I think I was talking to David about this too, about the concepts of the Gothic and like the past coming back to haunt. And, you know, we were talking about like, you know, like this is kind of like was part of like the start of like Manifest Destiny, of like, you know, the original colonies where they like killed the people that were living here and like you took mm-hmm. over. And you have so many relics of that throughout New England, obviously, and obviously throughout the entire country, but kind of like the oldest, monuments to like the destruction that was wreaked upon like the people here. You can't help but think that like that doesn't have something to it, or like that isn't an element of it. Getting to your question about the town, it was more just kind of an amalgam of a lot of different towns. Sometimes it would just be a town I would be like driving through, and like the layout of it made me think like, okay, this is what it looks like here. And then I'm like just taking like different pieces from other towns that I've like hung out with, like the different pieces of the places I would go to when I was like a scumbag teenager with like my scumbag teenage friends, and we'd get up to like no good.
Gas station Salvia.
Yeah, exactly. Like going, like breaking into like abandoned places, and you know, it's all just like little bits and pieces of different towns that have had an impact on me.
You know, obviously your character Tyler, if you want to talk a little bit about him, I'll say more or less that he becomes obsessed with the patron saint of suicide. And I think that concept is very unique. I mean, it's not like historically based, obviously, but was there any sort of influence for this concept that Tyler became so obsessed with?
Oh, like with the concept of the patron saint of suicide?
Yeah.
That was based off of this guy, I believe, also from New England. I think like late 1800s, early 1900s, he was obsessed with weighing the human soul. That was like his whole thing is like what he would do. So he worked at like a hospital, and when there were patients who were going to die, he had this enormous scale that he would bring the patients on, and they would expire on the scale, and he would measure the weight that the body lost while dying, in an attempt to try to like sort of measure the human soul. So that was the basic like foundational like aspect of it. I had initially written in the book this like long expository backstory that was like supposed to be like a conversation between Tyler and Amir. It was terrible. It was just dragged. If you're talking about like pacing, it just like tore the fucking like pacing down. It like went on for like three pages. It was just really, really, really bad. So I cut all of that, like, and there, but what I had like written in that was essentially that, like, I was implying that there was this guy, who may have been like a Nazi brought over on Project Paperclip, who was also obsessed with like the idea of like measuring the human soul. It was just like stealing that premise from this historical figure, and that he would, I had like written in this whole thing about how he was like kidnapping like vagrants and like, you know, like hanging them and then like measuring how much they would weigh, and then like finally he did that himself, did it to himself. Eventually it got to like, it's like, oh no, that's too cliche, blah blah blah. Then it got to, it's like he was obsessed with this, so he decided to like that he would hang himself to like see, like he would have like someone be able to take down the measurement, and he would like commit suicide for the benefit of discerning like the weight of the human soul. Again, it was all stuff that just like weighed down the book like way too much. It was like way too, just like too much expository information, completely unnecessary, and I like hate exposition anyway. Mm-hmm. So I took all of that, so now there's like a sentence about, you know, it's like, here, like we went to this place to try to like, you know, have a seance to conjure the spirit of this guy who is the patron saint of suicide, which to Tyler and the forum. But I think that's, he isn't known outside of that.
In terms of exposition, it kind of leads me to my favorite character in the book so far, is Lou.
Cool.
I'm trying to think of how to describe her, but essentially, and she's not like a vehicle. I mean, she feels very alive, but in the beginning, she kind of takes a back seat.
Mm-hmm.
But she's, of all the characters and all the chaos in this book and some of the exposition or lack thereof, she seems to be the one who really slowly sees what's going on.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
Was that a something that you set out to do, or did she kind of just naturally develop into this sort of like shaman role where she kind of understands?
That developed very naturally, I think. It's hard to like, it's very hard to pinpoint intention with like working on like something like over the course of like 3 years, because like while I was in it, I just kind of felt like I was flying by the seat of my pants and like just, you know, hoping my subconscious was going to guide me in the correct direction. Mm-hmm. But her developing a more central role, it came about naturally. It felt like it was the only thing that really made sense for that to happen. Like, because, you know, she's friends with Jill. She like knows about Tyler. She doesn't really have any contact with Amir. So she's kind of, and she doesn't have like Jill's really her only friend in like the beginning of the book. She's able to look at everyone else a little bit more objectively. Like she's watching others, which is how I felt like a lot of time, like when I was in high school, and it just made sense that like she would be able to like piece together more, at least more than any other character, that she was able to piece together what was going on by having a little bit more distance from it. She wasn't like fully embroiled and like fully enmeshed in the chaos that was going on.
Yeah, she seems to exist sort of like in the in-between space and kind of like all facets of her life. Even in my interpretation, between genders, like she's a gender fluid character. Maybe I'm wrong about that, in which case I will cut that from the interview.
oh, no worries, no worries, no worries. It's never like said like specifically. I always pictured her as like a trans character who's just like, you know, isn't recognized as such throughout by most of the characters, because it's about perspective and like shifting, like it's equally about like what people's actual selves are, as well as how other people perceive them. Mm-hmm. which was one of the huge benefits of having the revolving narrative.
So just to set the stage, like what is, for the people who haven't read it, what is the relationship between your main characters?
Oh, so that's interesting. So it all essentially revolves around this character, Tyler. You know, that's where all the spokes come out from. Amir is his best friend. Jill is his girlfriend and partner. And Lou is Jill's friend and like, but is very, very fascinated by Tyler. And they have like, you know, there are like interactions that happen, but it's also very limited from there.
So it's an extremely,
but you never, oh sorry.
No, go ahead.
I guess the key part is that like it's Tyler is central to it, but you never hear his perspective. You get everyone else's perspective except for Tyler's.
Yeah, you just
which
see
is
him,
like one of the keys, I think. Yeah.
You see him showing up with various drugs and various bad ideas and kind of like leading the action. But essentially, you know, for the Netflix people, it's like an extremely, you know, mystical, occult, dark, suicide heavy Stranger Things.
right. Absolutely. It's like Stranger Things, except like what being a teen actually is like.
Right.
Yeah.
Not like a bubblegum high school experience. Yeah.
Right. But yeah, no, that's a good way of summing it up. Yeah.
Yeah. So where did, I know this is like a tough question. It's for my, sometimes for class, I'm forced to answer the question, where did this idea come from?
Okay,
which I'm like, I don't know. I was like walking or something, and then I like saw a bird, and then, but generally speaking, when did you know you were gonna sit down and write this thing?
So it, like it's hyper specific. It's like it's weird. It's tied up in with like weird things. So in 2012, like my best friend took his own life. It was like obviously it was what it was, whatever. Worked through a lot of things since then. In 2013, a year after that, I didn't go to the funeral or anything. It was like it was a mess. By the way, like 2013, I finally like I'm kind of like okay, go like try to make some amends. I'm going to like finally go to his like gravesite, go to where he's buried. It's like an hour away from where I live. It's and like you go up through like these like woods. You go like go up like through these like mountains, like curling through. It's like this is gonna sound incredibly on the nose, but but anyway, so it's like I go up there. I'm like driving through like. Again, like all of these kind of like sort of like it's he like got buried in this place with it where his grandmother and grandfather were buried, who had like built this tunnel through a his grandfather had helped like build this tunnel through a mountain. It's like this depressed mill town in Western Massachusetts. I go up there, I'm like a fucking idiot. I didn't ask anyone who's like what cemetery was ba who he was like buried at. I was just like, oh, how many cemeteries can there be? Whatever, I'll find. Obviously, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. So I just pull in the first cemetery that I see. I go through, and in the middle of the road, there's a turtle on its back. This dead turtle with like a thin string of intestine just like pushed out the side of its body. It's just like this entire drive has just been so vibey. There's just like all these things going on, blah, blah, blah. So I'm driving back. Long story short, that's when the idea started, like have brewing. Like it was kind of, I don't know, it was like a way of like further like processing that, like through, because like that's like always how I've like done that stuff is like been through art. But like that's when kind of like the seeds of that we're starting. And like from there, I had like written a short story that was about that in like 2013 to 2014. It wasn't that good. But then I kind of felt like revisiting that around 2017. And like from there on, like that, like late, actually, it was like more like, yeah, like late 2016, 2017. I like was thinking about like different ideas of, turning the short story into a book. So then I just kind of like ran from there.
My last episode, I spoke with someone who wrote a memoir about a particularly traumatic moment in her life. And I asked, was there catharsis in finishing the memoir? And she was like, absolutely not. But
No, that's interesting.
I don't know if you've had a different, if you've had a different experience personally, getting this out of you.
Not really like a catharsis in like finishing it, but definitely catharsis in like the actual practice of writing it. Like like I'm not sure if it like if catharsis is the right word. It was just a matter of processing. Like I think like part of like grief and trauma, at least sort of like how I've had it like explained to me, is that it's like a visceral feeling that like you can't really transform into a narrative to be able to process. Like part of what we're part of like what humans do is like turn things into narrative in order to like process them and like better understand. So it's like there isn't necessarily that like that gut reaction. I'm not sure how true that is, but that sounds good. It was about allowing myself like a process of like privately grieving while also trying to like sort of channel it into something that was constructive or like just doing something with it. But like yeah, I mean it's like that like that book is grief. It, like, you know, I like wanted that book, like, you know, like that's kind of like the tone, is that like it, you know, my intent is for it to like feel like this like span of like grief and this like either, you know, the kind of impossible, also talking about like the impossibility of like catharsis, the impossibility of like processing it, mm-hmm. while also kind of like ironically doing that at the same time. But like, you know, it's never a static thing. Like, you know, like there's, you know, some days where like some like days or months where it's just like really like hanging in me. And then there's like other days where like other periods of time, mm-hmm. Where it's, you know, it's not so much, but you know, it's just a part of things that's, you know, it's an inevitability.
With grief and suicide as a theme in the book, you know, the way that the message boards function in an ironic way, where it's sort of like, you know, whenever these suicides occur, everyone gets on and they're like, oh my God, I, you know, another one, wow, it's happening. And it very much mimics the way that people talk on the internet about serious issues in my experience, but you know, people make what I guess I would call distasteful jokes about these things. And it kind of gives people a distance from the actual tragedy.
Well, yeah, I think it's a way of dealing with it in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, you see, so I talk with my friend a lot about how it's like, you know, like you just like, cause I'm like, I'm 36. So, you know, it's like, which is like weird in itself, but like I've seen.
Why is that weird?
Oh no, it's like for reasons that are like only like it's completely subjective. It's just the whole thing of aging and like, you know, like
yeah.
I got fucking runner's leg for the first time in my life. It's just like holy shit, like I have to care about this stuff now. But like being able like, and like I'm trying not to sound like the fucking like old man type of thing. It's interesting being like not being like the young people in the young person anymore, like, and like having there being like a very real generational gap. And like my buddy and I like talk about, it's like it's really interesting. It's just like the humor is just like so much darker, like for the younger, for Gen Z, I feel like I at least with like people, but like I don't think it's like a bad thing. Like I think that it's like it's a very natural response to, you know, the nightmare that everything has kind of become. But like talking about, it's like, you know, like the joke that I have is that like, you know, at some, you know, pretty soon, like the nation's leaders are really have to contend with the fact that they're facing a generation that like only knows jokes about suicide and are like fascinated by the Unabomber. Like it's just like, it's, I don't know. It's like a really interesting time in that they're in the fact of like people that people are being born into this fucking society. It's like, it's a fucking nightmare life. It's just like a bizarre fucking nightmare world. And like, you know, it's, you know, like I thought that like my generation like didn't have any hope and we're like, you know, just like for fucking cynical. It's just like, Jesus fucking Christ. I can't fucking imagine what it's like to like be like 16 right now. It's like, that's insane to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you say that, because I never want to sound like pessimistic, but I'm just, some days I'm just like,
oh, right.
This is a nightmare, right? Like this is this,
right.
It
right.
has to be, you know?
Right, right. No, absolutely. It's, yeah, no, it's just wild. It's wild shit.
It is wild shit. Well, your book mimics it nicely. It really is a great representation of this wild. It actually, in a way, is almost like nostalgic, even though it's steeped in message boards. But it is sort of like a nostalgic internet.
That's awesome. No, thank you. I really appreciate that. Like, and like, I mean, like, yeah, you're very much right with that, because it is a forum. And like, that was me writing about the kind of like the internet that I was like going on when I was 16 and 17 more. It was kind of pretending as if that like still existed today.
And wasn't just frogs carrying Nazi flags or whatever, you know, something a little something a little more creative.
Right. I mean, like, I mean, it's like obviously, like, you know, like, fuck all Nazis, like, fuck, like, forever. But like, there's like great, like, stuff. There's like wild stuff, like, that just comes from, like, I think, like, a lot of, like a lot of the people I've gotten to know who are, like, just like hyper disaffected, and like, mm-hmm. understandably so, because it's just like, it's just, you know, an insane, it's just like madness. It's like a mad fucking world. Talking about, like, even though it's a book that's like about, like, terrible things, that there's like this feeling of nostalgia to it. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you were saying. I do think that that's, like, also true, even though that's something I like, consciously I wanted it to be almost like anti-nostalgia, but like, it's not exactly, because, you know, like, my other friend put it best, that he said that was as though I transposed experiences I had when I was a teenager onto, like, the present generation. Like, I think that that's what I was trying to do. So it's, there is that, like, I guess there's that, like, nostalgia in that, you know, it reflects fucking fucked up shit that kids get into, mm-hmm. that you get into when you're kids. Mm-hmm. Obviously there's people who, like, write about that, like, really well, but, like, there can always be more, I feel like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, trying to have, like, that people don't give sort of, like, people in their teens, like, enough credit for, like, how complex their emotions and their sense of the world is, and, like, how fucked up they are. Like, and, like, it's just worth, I think it's, like, and I think just think that that's worth capturing,
especially now. Just, like, you know, I remember vaguely there being some sense of, like, parental control over what I saw on television and what websites I could access, either because they had the desktop in the living room and they'd come in and see, and, or, you know, it wasn't worth waiting on dial up to. But now it's like, my cousin just showed me this game I've been playing where everyone can talk to one another. Some kid got on there. He's like, "Hey, I'm Joe. I'm 11. And I'm like, "You can't be playing. Like, anyone can talk to you, little Joe."
Right,
I can't
imagine
being 14 years old now. It's like, there's no, as far as I know, I mean, yeah, sure, you can, there's YouTube Kids or something, but
right,
as soon as you get into the comment section, or you make a tweet, or you post a meme on Reddit that's stolen, and it's just horrible, the stuff you hear.
Yeah, you can't like block access to that. I mean, like, that's crazy to me, again, just because, like, yeah, I like didn't have like access to like old internet where there were like wasn't fucking anything on it pretty much, like, when I was like 12. And like, we didn't, like, there wasn't any social media, like, when I was in high school, like, outside of like weird obscure forums, and like, just like, and yeah, it's like, you can't like regulate that shit, like, for like kids. Like, kids are gonna get into it, and like, you know, we had like this like site like rotten.com or Ogrish, or like,
oh my god, I remember rotten.com.
oh shit, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like, that, like, those were kind of like those first like brushes with like, oh shit, the internet can be like real fucked up. Okay. Mm-hmm. But was so limited. Like, now there's like so much nightmare stuff on the internet. It's just like, there's like such huge percent, like, it's just crazy. I just don't understand what it could be like this fast. Like, it's like so overwhelming to like me now. I can't like imagine what it's like earlier on.
No,
and how you adapt to it. I just don't get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Thus the humor. That's the evolution of their dark humor. But is this space and this concept and this looming tower of the internet in our lives something that you're going to explore further in your work?
I think it'll always be there, because it will always, outside of like what's the event when there's like sunspots and it like wipes out all the electricity on the wipes out all like electrical devices on
the
Earth.
The sunstorm, right?
Right, right. Yeah. Like outside of that, like, this is like always gonna be like a big part of our lives. So I don't really see myself like not incorporating that or writing about that in certain ways in the future. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure how it's gonna manifest.
Yeah. Well, you've got Pearl Death, which is, is an interesting concept that I know almost nothing about, although it's a deck of cards, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was it's like a non-linear card novelette. There's no economical way of describing it. It's a history of a dead civilization told through objects printed on playing cards.
Wow, that sounds fantastic.
Cool, thank you.
how the hell did you think of that?
It was Diagram magazine, or the Diagram. They had published an anthology of short story of a flash fiction on a deck of cards. I just thought that was a really cool idea. I also really like tabletop, like role-playing games and card games in theory. I like barely played them at all. But like when I was younger, I used to read the source books all the time. I was really into just kind of reading about like descriptions of objects and lore.
Oh, I have to ask, if you're bringing up lore, are you a Bloodborne Dark Souls fan?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was the other side of it, was that I just wanted to just do a take on the item descriptions from Soft Games, because I just got very, 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 I like, it started with the original Dark Souls, but like I fell into that like really, really heavily.
They're incredible experiences.
They're phenomenal. Yeah. Absolutely. And I love the, it's been written about so many times before, but like I love that the way that the narrative unfolds or doesn't, depending on how much you pay attention. I love the way that I love the prose of the item descriptions. I just think that there's throughout all of those games, there's just like really terrific voice. I love the idea of it as like of microfiction that becomes a whole by like linking them together, you may miss some of it. And that's all dependent on the order in which you find it. Which was a big part of like, you know, doing it as a deck of cards. Like, I like the idea of that, that your perception of different people or different factions that are in the story will shift depending on what prior information you have. And that will be different each time you read it if you shuffle it thoroughly, as is instructed. Like magic cards and Dark Souls and it was just purely me like wanting to play in that realm a little bit. Yeah,
it's interesting, you know, we could have a whole nother podcast one day about video games, but it's interesting too, like the storytelling and just like the rich texture of the world, and specifically in those games, but you know, absolutely. I'm sure, and more. I didn't play the newest one. I didn't play the samurai one yet.
I fell off it a little bit. Yeah. It was very, very, very hard. I just kind of hit a wall. And the world design didn't like it. Didn't grab me as much as the previous ones. I would love to do like writing or narrative design on a game someday. Like that was the. If I could wrap my head around code and like, well, not even that, like it's just, if I had the patience for it,
right,
then I that was like, that's the other thing that I would love to do, but I just like, I don't have that patience. Like, it's just not my,
It's I think I try to take one of those like online coding courses once and I was like, this is humanly impossible for me.
Yeah.
So not gonna happen, but. Well, this has been great. I can't let you go, excellent horror writer that you are, without wondering on the eve of Halloween and this god-awful
Jesus Christ,
horrible timeline that we're living in. What are your future plans, both what are you doing for Halloween and what are you working on as an artist?
Awesome. I'm doing what I do every Halloween. I am meeting up with my spouse, and I are meeting up with my folks, and we're taking a nice walk in the woods and gonna have chili and candy and cider.
That sounds amazing. New England.
Yes, absolutely. You couldn't get more so. And we're watching Halloween 3 on the night of too.
Oh, great. Is it always three every Halloween? You guys vote and pick something new?
Oh, no, we do something different every Halloween. I think last year we did the first Halloween. The year before that, I think we did Candyman. The year before that, I think we did The Gate. Mm-hmm. The Gate is also like the big influence on Negative Space. That was like,
you know what? Early. I haven't seen The Gate, so it looks like I will be watching it.
That's true. One of my all-time favorite. It's just so good. It's such a good movie. That might be like, that's in my like top three or top five horror movies of all time. It's just phenomenal. Mm,
yeah.
So I kind of, I mean, this is an interesting guy, like conversation in itself, but, figuring out what to do next, and like climbing the mountain again. Cause mm-hmm. like, and realizing that like after finishing this last book, kind of feeling like I know less about writing a book than I ever did before. like it was just like not knowing how to go into it. So I'm thinking that the next thing is either going to be a novel that's going to take like the next 3 or 4 years of my life, or it's going to be like a collection of short stories that I still have to write that will probably be like a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then also working on the novel that'll take like 3 to 4 years of my life. We'll see. It's very early on in both of those, mm-hmm. For both of those projects.
Well, whatever it is, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, this is just an entirely unique, enthralling experience reading this book.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that's awesome.
It was really phenomenal. I'm a fan. So I'll be
awesome. thank you so much.
I'll be staying tuned, and it's great to have you. I really appreciate your time.
That was B.R. Yeager. Thanks for listening in. As always, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter or Instagram at SelectedPros. Check out our website, selectedpros.com. Check out some of BR's books. You can find links in the episode description. I know you will enjoy them. Looking forward to the next episode, having you all here again. We'll be talking with Elle Nash about her novel Animals Eat Each Other, some of her upcoming work, and a lot more. Stay tuned.